2014, A24 released the movie A Most Violent Year. Taking place in 1981, the movie's title refers to the record violence in the New York metropolitan area that year. The film was accompanied by a short documentary featuring folks who lived through this most violent year.
What I remember about 1981 was it was epitomized by the film with Kurt Russell, Escape from New York. Because if you had the wherewithal, you were getting the hell out of here as quick as you can.
This violence wasn't confined to New York City, spilling over to neighboring Newark, New Jersey, mere miles away. In 1981, there were 161 murders in Newark, a record that still stands today. This record violence led to many business owners fleeing the city to protect themselves and their employees. But two brothers decided to stay and ply their trade, with one of them losing their life. This is the story of the brother who was killed, the teenager wrongfully convicted of his murder, and his recent release from prison 45 years later, as well as the continuing fight to prove his innocence.
Hi, and welcome back to Undisclosed, Toward Justice. I'm Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author, and I'm here with my colleague, Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm a professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
In May 1981, Jewish brothers Milton and Harry LaFure ran LaFure Carpet Works at 71 Shipman Street in Newark. A family business, the carpet store had been in operation since 1901, when it was founded by their father. Now, 80 years later, 71-year-old Milton and 60-year-old Harry held down the fort. On Friday, May 22, 1981, the brothers were joined in their office at the carpet store by their insurance agent, James Robitello. The brothers had insurance covering calamities like fires and floods, but the area was so dangerous that Robitello's company wouldn't cover crimes like burglaries and theft. While Shipman Street was once a thriving hub filled with bustling businesses, the block now just housed the carpet shop, a church, and a funeral parlor. Shortly before noon on that Friday in May, the brothers and Robitello headed to Hobby's Delicatessen, about half a mile away. Still standing today, Hobby's tells customers it was established before you were born and boasts the best pastramis in America. After lunch, Harry went to copy some documents, while Robitello brought Milton to a bank to do some transactions. According to both Harry and Robitello, the three men returned to the carpet store sometime between 1 and 1:10 p.m. When they arrived, there was an employee who hadn't been picked up for a carpet install job, so they sorted things out for a few minutes. The men then headed to the carpet store's office, where Harry went to his desk and saw a note that someone had called who needed to be called back. And so, Harry had his back turned to the office door as he twice tried to return the phone call. While his back was turned, two young men entered the office at about 1:15 p.m. Upon entering, they told Milton to give them money. In response, Milton told them they needed to leave. Apparently, the two young men weren't very threatening. Robitello would say that he thought they were kibitzing, i.e. making small talk. And Harry was so unbothered that he didn't even turn around. Even when one of the young men pulled a gun on Milton, Robitello wasn't sure whether it was a cap gun or the real McCoy. He would later describe it as a small caliber pistol. The young man who didn't pull out the gun walked up to Milton and started rooting through his pockets for money. After striking pay dirt, he started walking away. It was around this time when Harry turned around. He would later testify at trial that when he turned around, he was facing the gun. The prosecutor would have to follow up by asking, "While you were watching the gun, you would have had to see his face." Harry said that he did, but it wasn't long before he saw sparks coming out of the gun, followed by the young men running away. The bullet struck Milton in the stomach and blood started pouring out. Robitello responded by pulling out a handkerchief and pushing it against the gunshot wound to try and stem the bleeding. Meanwhile, Harry called 911 to try to get an ambulance. But when that was taking too long, Robitello and he decided to carry Milton to their car. Harry then drove Milton to the hospital while Robitello remained at the carpet shop. Back in the office of the carpet shop, Robitello called the police from the office phone at 1:40 p.m. He estimated he called the cops 10 minutes after the young men had left. In other words, they would have left the office at 1:30 p.m. 1 minute after Robitello's call to the cops, at 1:41 p.m., we have the first notations in Milton's medical file from St. Michael's Medical Center, the hospital about a mile away from the carpet store where his brother Harry had brought him. According to Harry, Milton was trying to talk, but all that came out was a gurgling sound. After being treated, Milton was able to briefly talk, but he didn't say anything about the shooter or his accomplice. But Harry did. He spoke to police officers, and his description of the two young men who had entered the carpet store office was printed in the Newark Star-Ledger the next day. Harry said the two young men were teenagers and described them as follows. Quote, he described one as about 5 feet 5 inches tall, slender, and wearing a blue jacket. And, quote, he said the other was wearing a gray jacket, orange shirt, and was also slender and about 5 feet 4 inches tall. Milton's murder remained unsolved for another 39 days until June 30th, 1981, when Milton's brother Harry was shown a police lineup of six men. One of those men was 19-year-old Darren Boykins, who worked at a local clinic for seniors in Newark. Here, Darren's mother, Carmela Bowers, now 86 years old, describes her son.
Darren he didn't use drugs at all. He was a child that, you know, didn't experiment with drugs. And he was, a happy-go-lucky boy. He liked girls. And he played with his brothers. He had brothers, because I had four boys and four girls and sisters. And they were close. And, you know, I guess just like the average child, he was very loving, very caring. You know, care for his family, look after his family. They all looked after each other. Because I taught them, nobody come before your family.
To understand how Darren ended up in that lineup, we need to first rewind back to January 7th, 1981. According to a man named Andre Loney, he and Alfred Boatwright were at an apartment that belonged to their 23-year-old friend, Thomas Pinckney. While they were there, two and possibly three men robbed him at gunpoint, with one of the men fatally shooting Pinckney. Essex County homicide investigator James Gold was the lead agent on the case, and he came to believe that Darren Boykins was one of the robbers. He eventually arrested Darren in connection with the crime. After the arrest, Gold told Darren's mother, Carmela, that he thought that Darren did it because, quote, he tried to be a tough little guy. Carmela responded that her son didn't do it. Carmela turned out to be right. Darren was working at the senior clinic at the time of the crime, and his boss was able to confirm this alibi. Again, here's Darren's mother, Carmela.
And they were trying to put the murder on my son, Darren. They had locked him up for that. But he was working with Fish Floyd.
Right.
So when Fish Floyd seen that, he went to the court and told him that he was working on that day. He was with him and told him where it was. So they let him go.
Right.
As Carmela notes, the charges were dropped and Darren was released. Two other men, Anthony Gross and Clifford Plant, were eventually convicted of the crime, with Plant possibly implicating a third man, Charlie Williams, in that murder. Next, let's fast forward to June 28, 1981. This was 37 days after the murder of Milton at his carpet shop. On June 28th, Darren was arrested on an aggravated assault warrant in connection with the shooting of Thomas Barrett. This assault allegedly happened on May 27th and supposedly involved a shooting after an argument about Barrett's bicycle. Darren was arrested on the morning of June 28th while riding his moped, and he had a .22-caliber pistol in his pocket. And in case you're wondering, no, the .22 didn't end up being the murder weapon. After being arrested, Darren was taken to the police headquarters and kept in a cell overnight. Then, the next day, June 29th, at about 1 p.m., Darren said something happened. According to Darren, a detective named Jack Utsi got him from his cell, took him downstairs, and told him to stand in front of a mirror. Darren didn't know what was going on, but he complied, standing in front of the mirror, and standing, and standing. According to Darren, he stood in front of that mirror for 3 to 5 minutes before Detective Utsi finally took him back to his cell. The next day, June 30th, Darren was put in the lineup for Milton's brother Harry, who would identify him as one of the men who robbed the carpet store. Years later, when asked why he thought that Harry identified him, Darren would write without spaces and in pencil, "They put me in front of a glass mirror." Darren's charges for his alleged assault of Thomas Barrett were eventually dismissed, but the day after Harry's identification of Darren, on July 1st, 1981, he was charged with the murder of Milton LaFleur. But there was a big problem with this identification, which was that once again, Darren had an alibi. The afternoon of the carpet shop shooting was when his mother was graduating from Rutgers University. Again, here's Darren's mother, Carmela.
So that's when I went to the police department, and Detective Gold, he saw me. And he was saying, my son killed this man in the store. I said, when was that? Mm-hmm. So he told me the date.
I said, oh, no, that's impossible, because that day he was at my graduation. He was working. They let him off a half a day to come to my graduation. And from the time they let him off and he got to the house, he was there. He never left. And he went to the graduation with my cousin. He brought him. So I said, so it couldn't have been my son. So when he found that out, he told me, well, I'm going to prove he did it. And I said, and I'm going to prove he didn't.
Spring has sprung, and we aren't the only ones experiencing allergies. Have you ever noticed, like, your little furry friend doing something weird, like scratching, licking their paws, shaking their head, you know, just acting off, sometimes eating grass, being prone to ear infection? I mean, there's so many different signs, and a lot of people can't figure out what is going on with their pup. But these aren't normal dog behaviors. They're actually signs of allergies. And what I learned is, just like in human beings, allergies in dogs often start out in the gut. When things get out of balance internally, it can show up everywhere. It shows up in issues with their skin, ears, digestion, and energy. And just like us, dogs need good bacteria to strengthen their gut health and calm an overactive immune system. That is where Better Wild Allergy Relief Soft Chews come in. They are designed to support your pet's allergy defenses by strengthening digestion and helping restore balance from the inside. They are the first and the only chews that have something called Ancestral Advantage Wolf Probiotics and other natural ingredients proven to help reduce itching and support gut, immune, and skin health. So instead of just covering up all the symptoms and addressing the symptoms, by giving your pet friend Better Wild Allergy Relief Soft Chews, you're actually supporting your dog at the source. So many of my friends have beloved dogs who are their companions, and, you know, they care for them just like any of us care for our children. And about a year ago, I recommended Better Wild Allergy Relief Soft Chews to one of my dearest friends for her dog, and she has seen an incredible improvement, not just like in the dog's behaviors, but just in his overall well-being. I know a lot of us are being much more intentional about taking care of our own wellness, but it's time that we also did the same for our pets. Better Wild is committed to helping your dogs with clinically proven, veterinarian-approved solutions that you can feel great about. And right now, Better Wild is offering our listeners up to 40% off your order at betterwild.com/justice. That's betterwild.com/justice for up to 40% off your order. betterwild.com/justice.
Specifically, according to multiple witnesses, Darren came to his mother's house shortly before graduation and then attended her ceremony. To set this alibi up, recall that Milton and James Robitello both say the robbers entered the carpet store office at about 1:15 p.m., with Robitello adding the men left at 1:30 p.m., 10 minutes before he called the police at 1:40 p.m. And for reference, Darren's mother, Carmela, lived about 2 miles away from the carpet shop. So let's start with what Carmela said. For her, this was a huge day. She was a high school dropout who had mothered 8 children. But in addition to being a mother and having a job, she had worked toward her associate's degree at Rutgers University, with her graduation ceremony being scheduled for 2 p.m. that day. Darren had agreed with his boss that he would work a half a day at his job so he could attend graduation, which was amazing news for Carmela, who got extra tickets so that all her loved ones could attend.
Went out the way to give me extra tickets, you know, because they were so proud of me. When I was at Essex County College, I won the criminal justice scholarship for my graduation. I was an AB student.
Right.
And that was after coming out of school when you're young, and when you're out of school a long time and you're not doing anything, you forget that. And I had to start all over again. And I came out with AB average.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was marvelous.
Absolutely.
Carmela said that Darren arrived at her house at around 1 p.m., wearing a green sweatshirt. By way of contrast, you might recall that Harry LaFleur said the robbers were wearing blue and gray jackets. According to Carmela, she was leaving for graduation just as Darren was getting to her house to change. She then says that the graduates started lining up for the ceremony between 1:45 and 2 p.m., whereupon she saw her son in the crowd in dress clothes. After the ceremony, a photo was taken with Darren, his mother, and Carmela's mother, Darren's grandmother. When Darren was arrested, Carmela brought this photo to Detective Yutzi, whom she'd known since they were young.
We were friends, and he played me, and he was the one that I found out that was the one accusing my son. All of us grew up together as friends, close, singing on the corner and everything. And that's what he did to me, to my son.
As Carmela notes, this photo didn't move the needle, with Yutzi and Gold forging forward with full force against Darren.
But this graduation photo takes us to Darren's grandmother, Minnie Hamlet, Darren's second alibi witness. She said that she got to her daughter's house at about 10 a.m. on graduation day. According to Minnie, Darren arrived at the house between 1 and 1:10 p.m. and went upstairs to change clothes. With Darren still upstairs, she left with a few people to go to the graduation between 1:10 and 1:15 p.m. A third alibi witness was NYPD officer Leon Scott, Carmela's first cousin. He said that he arrived at Carmela's house at noon and that Darren later arrived at the house at about 1 or 1:05 p.m. dressed casually. Scott said that Darren went upstairs to change clothes and hadn't left by about 1:20 or 1:25 p.m., which is when his crew and he headed over to graduation. Leon then said that he saw Darren with changed clothes shortly before the graduation ceremony started between 1:50 and 1:55 p.m. A fourth alibi witness was Dolores Maybank, Carmela's friend. She said she left work and arrived at Carmela's house at about 12:30 p.m. Maybank added that she left the house to go to graduation between 1 and 1:15 p.m. just as Darren arrived at the house. Taking these statements together, they all say that Darren arrived at Carmela's house roughly between 1 and 1:15 p.m. Three of these witnesses left for graduation at around the time Darren arrived, while Officer Scott stuck around for a little bit longer, with Darren not having come downstairs by the time Officer Scott left at around 1:20 or 1:25 p.m. Again, Harry LaFleur and James Robitello placed the robbers at the carpet store from roughly 1:15 to 1:30 p.m., which would mean that Darren clearly did not commit the crime if we believe these alibi witnesses, because they say he arrived at his mother's house between 1 and 1:15 p.m. and hadn't left by 1:20 or 1:25 p.m. And because Darren couldn't be in two places at the same time, he could not have committed this crime. There was also a final fifth alibi witness, Collins Hagler. Hagler was Darren's youth counselor who helped him when Darren was having issues with his father.
And my son had been to the youth house.
Right.
Because, like, he was, you know, with his father, me and his father, we had problems. He used to fight me. So I divorced him.
This youth counselor, Collins Hagler, had two daughters graduating from Rutgers on the afternoon of Milton's murder. He said that he arrived at graduation at about 1:15 p.m., went to the plaza to sit with his family, and then ran into Darren a few minutes later. Hagler estimated that he saw Darren between about 1:30 and 1:45 p.m. For reference, the graduation ceremony was about half a mile from Carmela's house. According to Hagler, he spoke with Darren for several minutes. As noted, Hagler was Darren's youth counselor, and he specifically remembered that when he spoke with Darren, he asked him why he wasn't doing as well as his mother. According to Hagler, after speaking with Darren, he walked back over to his family and sat down just as the graduates started coming out at 1:50 p.m. Breaking all this down, if we believe these alibi witnesses, it seems likely that Darren finished changing and left his mother's house at about 1:30 p.m. shortly after Officer Scott got to graduation and started talking with Collins Hagler at about 1:40 p.m. Given this, you might wonder how the prosecution secured Darren's conviction. Well, there were two ways. The first was a sixth alibi witness whom the defense didn't call at trial. Her name was Veronica Hendricks, and she was another of Carmela's first cousins. After Darren was arrested, Carmela asked her to write a letter about what she remembered about the day of graduation. In response, Hendricks wrote that she remembered Darren coming to Carmela's house at 1:30 p.m., just as she was leaving to go to graduation. Now, as noted, the defense didn't call Hendricks at trial, and neither did the prosecution. So how did her letter get before the jury? Somewhat shockingly, defense counsel stipulated to its admission. Of course, that deals with the law. But let's look at the facts. The four other alibi witnesses from the house all say that Darren arrived between 1 and 1:15 p.m. Hendrick's estimate was a bit later, at 1:30 p.m. So, sake of argument, let's say she was right. Well, recall that James Robitello said that the two robbers left the carpet shop at 1:30 p.m., 10 minutes before he called the police at 1:40. And again, that carpet shop was about 2 miles from Carmela's house. So even if this later estimate of Darren's arrival is right, it still places him at his mom's house. At the same time, James Robitello says that the two robbers were leaving the carpet shop. But that didn't matter to the prosecutor. In closing arguments, he would compare the case to this lyric from the Young Rascals song, "How Can I Be Sure?" Whenever I'm away from you, my alibi is telling people I don't care for you. According to the prosecutor, both this lyric and Darren's alibi were about excuses. Of course, this mischaracterized both the song and Darren's alibi, because they're both about loving someone, not making excuses. After citing these lyrics, the prosecutor said, "There was no question that he was at that graduation. The issue is about why. And the answer is because something went wrong when he tried to rip off LaFleur's warehouse carpet." But we know that's not true. Darren had planned ahead and gotten a half day at work so he could go to graduation. And while the prosecutor claimed that Darren could have committed the crime before arriving at his mother's house, even Veronica Hendricks' letter had him arriving at the same time that James Robitello said the robbers were leaving. Moreover, we know Darren couldn't have arrived any later because he had to be at graduation by about 1:40 p.m. to talk with Collins Hagler, his youth counselor.
But this didn't matter to the jury. And that's because the state had one more card up its sleeve, a jailhouse informant.
A thoughtfully built wardrobe comes down to pieces that mix well and last. That is where Quince shines. They've got premium fabrics, considered design, and everyday essentials that feel effortless to wear and dependable even as the seasons change. Quince has everyday essentials that I love with quality that lasts. They've got lightweight cashmere sweaters, short-sleeve Mongolian cashmere polos, linen bottoms and shorts, tees in 100% Pima cotton, and European jersey linen. These are versatile, elegant, classic pieces that make a wardrobe actually work season to season and make you stand out. Quince makes you look elegant without the price tag. That's because they work directly with top factories and they cut out the middlemen. You're not paying for brand markup or fancy retail stores, just quality clothing. Their clothing is rated 5 stars by thousands of people who wear it every single day. And that's because they partner with factories that not just have ethical production, but they also meet rigorous standards for their craftsmanship. I've gotten the linen shorts for my son. He looks so classy in them. They do not wrinkle like cheap linen does. They work with everything, and they didn't cost a fortune ever. Remember what Leonardo da Vinci said? Simplicity is the ultimate sophistication, and you can look sophisticated without the brand markup with Quince. Right now, go to quince.com/towardjustice for free shipping and 365-day returns. That's a full year to build your wardrobe and love it. And you will. Now available in Canada, too. Don't keep settling for clothes that don't last. You don't need a closet full of options. You just need a few pieces that actually work and last. So go to quince.com/towardjustice for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/towardjustice.
That jailhouse informant was named Alvin Holt. Holt was locked up with Darren in August 1981 on charges of sexually assaulting his girlfriend's daughters, ages 2 and 3, as well as the murder of John McCall, a former Marine gunned down during a robbery outside the Beth Israel Hospital. According to Holt, he had never interacted with Darren before Darren came up to him and immediately started confessing to the crime. Specifically, Holt said that Darren confessed, quote, "Me and my man, we went in there to stick the joint up, and we had the cracker under the surveillance, and he didn't act right, and somebody was coming, and I had to shoot him." When asked whether Darren said what type of place this was where the shooting occurred, Holt answered, quote, "No, he didn't. He just said it was a garage." Hull added that Darren told him he didn't get any money from the robbery and told him he would beat the charges because he had a security guard who would say he was at graduation on the night of the robbery. Of course, there's not a lot right about what Holt said. The robbery and homicide were at a carpet shop, not a garage. The shooting wasn't preceded by anyone coming into the office. James Robitello said that one of the robbers had taken money from Milton, and Darren didn't have a security guard as an alibi witness. But Darren did say he was at graduation, albeit in the early afternoon, not at night as Holt had said. And so, you might imagine what the jury did with Holt's eventual testimony at trial. Thought that Darren did confess to him, and that Holt had simply gotten some of the details mixed up in his head. In the end, in the battle between Darren's alibi witnesses versus Harry's identification and Holt's claimed confession, the latter two won out, and Darren was convicted. Over the next 4.5 decades, life has been rough for Darren and his mother. Here's his mother, Carmela, talking about the toll it's taken on her and her son.
And by him being in jail all them years, messed with his mind.
Right.
Because he was in there for something he did not do, and he was 19 years old. And now he's 65.
Mm-hmm.
But, well, he'll be 65 in July. Anyway, it's just sad. It was so sad for me. I did a lot of paperwork. Getting it back in court with lawyers trying to get it back.
The issues that Darren faced in prison were exacerbated when he was attacked by his cellmate. His injuries were so severe that he was transferred to the Southwood State Prison for medical treatment. And while he was treated, Darren has been left with severe physical and mental health issues. Again, here's his mother, Carmela.
That's so sad. No, I just feel so sorry for him. I done did everything I could to try to get him out for years. It just, you know, and this is the only time where I'm 86 years old, and I was 85. Now somebody is really trying to help him. So God is going to let him come home. I know he's going to come home before I die. And I'm so happy.
This combination of sadness and hope comes from developments with Darren's case. Some dead ends, others possibly bearing fruit. Let's start by going back to basically one of the only two witnesses to incriminate Darren at trial, jailhouse informant Alvin Holt. Years after Darren's conviction, Holt came forward to say that Darren did not confess to him and that this alleged confession was fed to him by investigator James Gold.
Right.
He said Gold told him what to say and wrote it down and told him to memorize it. Gave him the paper, told him to memorize what he had to say. That's what he told us in court.
So why would Gold do this? Recall that investigator Gold thought that Darren Boykins committed the murder of Thomas Pinckney in 1981 before Darren's boss established his alibi. Well, according to Alvin Holt, Gold still clung to that belief that Darren was guilty of that murder. And so, according to Holt, when Gold approached him about the murder of Milton LaFleur, Gold told him, quote, "The bastard ain't going to get away with it this time." And, according to Holt, to secure Holt's statement against Darren, he sweetened the pot. You'll recall that Holt was in prison for sexually assaulting his girlfriend's 2- and 3-year-old daughters, as well as the murder of John McCall. Well, guess what? On the very same day that Holt signed a sworn statement that Darren had confessed to him, the murder charge against Holt was dismissed. Soon thereafter, so were the sexual assault charges against the two daughters, with Holt only copying a plea to assaulting and intimidating a witness to these investigations. But, in the end, as with so many jailhouse informants who recant, it wasn't enough. The appellate court found that Holt was lacking in credibility, and it wasn't enough to toss Darren's murder conviction.
This then takes us to a second development since Darren's been in prison. When we noted earlier that Darren had been placed in a police lineup for Milton's murder while he was locked up on another charge, you might have wondered why he ended up in that lineup. Well, it turned out there was an anonymous tip that was not disclosed to the defense at the time of trial. According to this anonymous tip, which was received June 29, 1981, Darren Boykins and Dennis Brown were the two teenagers who committed the crime at the carpet shop. The report on the tip by Detective Utsi makes clear that this tip was the reason that Darren was placed in the lineup for Milton's brother Harry on June 30th. Of course, June 29th, the date of the tip, is also the date when Darren says Detective Utsi had him stand in front of the mirror for 3 to 5 minutes. Now, Detective Utsi's report goes on to explain what was done with Dennis Brown, the other teenager named in the tip. According to the report, Dennis Brown was brought in and questioned about the robbery and murder at the carpet shop. And then, the report noted that Dennis Brown was given a polygraph test and found to be untruthful when denying knowledge of the crime. Of course, polygraph results are inadmissible in court, but we know that law enforcement sees them as a valuable tool in investigating crimes. And yet, there are no records of Dennis Brown being arrested or charged in connection to the murder of Milton LaFleur. That's troubling, because there's other evidence in the record that maybe makes Dennis Brown a strong suspect in the case. The problem is that we don't have the source documents.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
In the records, there's a reference to Lieutenant John Edwards in the Newark Police Department's juvenile unit saying that there are records indicating two things. First, that Dennis Brown is violent. And second, that he exactly fit the description of the robbers. Now, this second point is something you might have been wondering about through this episode. As you'll recall, on the day of the shooting, Harry LaFleur gave the Newark Star-Ledger a description of the two teenage robbers. He described them both as slender, with one being 5'4" and the other being 5'5". As noted, Lieutenant Edwards said that the correctional records showed that Dennis Brown exactly fit the description of the robbers. In other words, he was slender and about 5'4" or 5'5". So, what about Darren Boykins? The correctional records show that Darren was 5'10" and 185 pounds, meaning that Darren was about half a foot taller than the description given by Harry LaFleur on the day of the shooting. And while body mass index, or BMI, is a flawed measure for several reasons, it gives a BMI of 25.8 for someone who is 5'10 and 185 pounds. That falls within the overweight range of BMI between 25 and 29.9. Again, there are flaws with BMI, but that at least seems inconsistent with Darren meeting the description of a slender teenager. Now, notably, the jury never heard about Dennis Brown or the description of the teenagers given by Harry LaFleur at trial. Indeed, Darren's mother was unaware about either detail until Colin spoke with her. Let's start with the descriptions of the robbers given by Harry on the day of the shooting.
He was about 5'10", because him and my son Donnie was about the same then. He was 19 years old.
Yeah. Have you
and
seen...
Donnie was old, yeah.
Have you seen or heard the description of the two robbers that this was Harry, the brother of the victim, gave to the Newark Star-Ledger? Are you aware of that? He said one of them was 5'4", and the other one was 5'5". Which,
I didn't know that.
No, I mean...
I didn't know that.
How does that feel, hearing that on the day of the shooting, he described the two shooters as 5'4" and 5'5", and your son is 5'10", which is like half a foot taller.
Right. My son was kind of tall, but my husband was 6 feet.
Uh-huh.
So my Johnny and Darren, they were kind of tall.
Hmm?
They were, and my daughter, Michelle, was the tallest girl. She was about 5'7".
And then there was the anonymous tip.
It was Dennis Brown. I don't know if you've ever been aware of the name Dennis Brown.
You know something? I know right round. And, so, you know, years later, some people were saying that Brown had committed the murder.
He
That's what they told me.
And he failed.
Some people in
yeah. They gave him a lie detector test about the murder, and he failed the lie detector test.
Wow. Well, they never told me that.
No.
They never told me that. No.
John might have told you that there was this anonymous tip that named someone else as well as your son. Now, the other person who was named was about 5'4", 5'5", and so that lines up with the description. But yeah, your son being 5'10", that does not line up at all with what the eyewitness told the police on the day of the shooting.
But no other person never went to court with my son for that murder.
Right. Yeah, he was never prosecuted for that murder.
It was just my son?
Right.
Huh?
Right, it was just your son. The other young man was never prosecuted for that murder.
I don't even know who the other man could have been.
And so now there is a new line of investigation that's been reopened 45 years after the crime. Was Dennis Brown involved in the murder of Milton LaFleur? And there's someone on the case who might crack it. His name is John Creighton. He's a 74-year-old semi-retired attorney who first started working on Darren's case at the New Jersey Innocence Project at Rutgers, the same school whose graduation ceremony was Darren's alibi all the way back in 1981. As noted, John Creighton is semi-retired. This is the one case he keeps working out of his garage office. And recently, he filed a motion for discovery seeking, among other things, all the evidence related to the investigation of Dennis Brown in connection with Milton's murder.
Of course, an argument could be made that the non-disclosure of Dennis Brown back in 1981 was a Brady violation. As you might imagine, the state says this evidence connected to the tip is inculpatory and not exculpatory because it named Darren Boykins in addition to Dennis Brown. But let's game this out. If this tip were disclosed to the defense back in 1981, one of two things might have happened. First, assume the state thought that Dennis Brown was indeed one of the robbers at the carpet shop, even though he's never been prosecuted. The defense could have done two things at trial. First, distance Darren Boykins from Dennis Brown, and establish that Dennis must have committed the crime with someone else. And second, highlight the heights and weights given by Harry LaFleur on the day of the shooting. Again, Harry said the robbers were between 5'4 and 5'5, with slender builds. Sure, Darren Boykins was about half a foot taller and a good bit wider than this description, but maybe Harry was bad at estimating heights and weights. But if there were evidence at trial that Dennis Brown was one of the robbers, it would make no sense that Harry saw Darren towering over Dennis about half a foot taller and thought the two young men had similar heights. And then, what about the other side of the equation? Given that Dennis Brown was never prosecuted in connection with the carpet shop robbery, let's assume the police did rule him out as one of the perpetrators. In that case, the prosecution of Darren Boykins was flawed from the start, because then the anonymous tip that led to Darren being placed in the lineup was clearly wrong, because Dennis Brown was not involved. This is similar to the C.J. Rice case we recently presented on the podcast, in which the theory was that C.J. committed a shooting with a friend who ended up having a rock-solid alibi of video evidence showing him cleaning an office park with his mother and brother. So that's Brady, but there's another arrow in the appellate quiver, and it's one that John Creighton has raised in a new filing. And that's this. Darren Boykins was not under arrest for the murder of Milton LaFleur when he was compelled to take part in the lineup for Milton's brother Harry. Again, he was locked up for the aggravated assault of Thomas Barrett, a charge that was later dropped. And so the question is whether Darren could be compelled to take part in the lineup without being arrested for Milton's murder based upon an anonymous tip and without any judicial recognition of reasonable suspicion. And this is where I came into play. After reading about Darren's case, I reached out to John Creighton last year, and he sent me all of his files from the case, which I devoured over the winter break.
Yeah, I think John told me that he was talking to a lawyer that he wanted me to talk to, so I suppose it must have been you.
Yep, that's me, and I'm working with John on it now. I found a pretty good case that we're going to use in the appeal, so we feel pretty good, but you never know.
Yeah, you never know.
Mm.
But I know. I don't care if nobody else knows. I know.
Right.
that he was at my graduation. So I know he didn't do that.
The case that I found and mentioned to Carmela is an appellate court opinion from New Jersey in 1976, meaning it was rendered 5 years before Darren's arrest. And the facts of the two cases are the same. A man named Andrew Foy was arrested for one crime and then compelled to take part in a lineup for another crime. In finding this was unconstitutional, the court concluded that to place someone like Foy in a lineup for an unrelated crime, you need two things. First, quote, a well-grounded suspicion that the suspect committed the second crime. Now here, reasonable minds might disagree over whether this anonymous tip supplied reasonable suspicion. But second, and more importantly, the court concluded that, quote, the validity of this well-grounded suspicion must be tested by a neutral and detached magistrate. An affidavit by the prosecuting attorney attesting to its existence will not suffice. Here, this was never done. No judge was ever asked to render an opinion on whether there was reasonable suspicion to believe that Darren had murdered Milton. And what this means is that Darren has a strong argument for his murder conviction being reversed. I reached out to the district attorney's office to see if they had any comment, but they haven't responded yet.
But while it's not clear if and when Darren will be exonerated for the 1981 murder of Milton LaFleur, one thing is clear. Darren will no longer wait behind bars. Last year, John Creighton filed a petition with New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy. That petition asked for a commutation of Darren's sentence to time served, which would mean his release from behind the bars of his prison cell. And this January, with just a few hours remaining in Murphy's term as governor, he granted the motion, commuting Darren's sentence. But the news isn't all good. John Creighton expected that, after Darren was released from prison, he would be sent to a program for cognitively impaired parolees. Instead, he was transferred to New Jersey's Forensic Hospital, which is not a prison, but isn't that much better. This is not yet the happy ending that anyone wanted. As John Creighton told the New Jersey Monitor, this is not a happy ending. It's just the next step, and it's probably, hopefully, a much better place for Darren. I am determined to get the state of New Jersey to admit to their injustice 45 years ago. This should never have happened to him. With the appeal that John Creighton recently filed and the precedent from the Foy case about a judge needing to sign off on someone like Darren being put into a lineup, Darren may be closer to having his name cleared than ever before. And as always, we will keep you updated if there are any changes in his case.
Hey, Undisclosed listeners, it's Meethal, executive producer of Undisclosed Toward Justice. Before I roll through the credits, I've got a few quick notes. By now, most of you probably know about our Facebook community group. If you haven't joined yet, please go to facebook.com/groups/towardjustice and answer 3 simple questions and you're in. But seriously, answer the questions because a bunch of you are still pending since you've only answered 1 or 2. They're easy questions, I promise. In addition to engaging with us through the Facebook group, you can also leave us a voice note at speakpipe.com/undisclosed. We always check the messages, and so far, I think we've answered all of them. We also have a Patreon page with 3 different tiers of perks, the lowest one just being $1, which allows us to continue to do this work. Other tiers include bonus episodes, early access to merch, and even joining Rabia in a live true crime Zoom discussion. Just go to patreon.com/undisclosedpod. Now, onto the real credits. A huge shout out to Hannah McCarthy for audio production. Thank you to Patrick Cortez and Romero Marquez for our theme music. For anyone new here, you can engage with us online by going to Instagram or Facebook at Undisclosed Podcast. We're also on TikTok, YouTube, and X at Undisclosed Pod. Whether you're a new or returning listener, you can always check out our previous cases and bonus episodes by going to our website at undisclosedpod.com. If you would like to follow Colin and Rabia on social media, you can find Rabia at RabiaSquared2 on Instagram and Colin at EvidenceProf on Instagram, X, and Blue Sky. Thank you all for your continued support and for supporting all of our sponsors. Until next time.